Wisp Sports Radio, the voice of women in sport.
Thank you for downloading Tucker Center Talks. This is Season 2, Episode 8. You're listening to Tucker Center Talks, a podcast from the Tucker Center for Research on Girls and Women in Sport at the University of Minnesota and a co-production with Wisp Sports. I'm your host for Tucker Center Talks, Dr. Nicole Lavoie, director of the Tucker Center. In this podcast, I'm going to talk to Dr. Dahiya Barr-Anderson. Dr. Barr-Anderson's research interests focus on physical activity, sedentary behaviors, and obesity prevention in children and adolescents. She's an associate professor in the School of Kinesiology and is the director of the Behavioral Physical Activity Laboratory at the University of Minnesota, my colleague and Tucker Center affiliated scholar and all-around great human being. Welcome, Dr. Barr-Anderson.
Thank you so very much, Dr. Lavoie. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's been a long journey for us during this pandemic to connect with each other, to get on this podcast. So I'm really grateful that we can record this so our Tucker Center Talks listeners can learn more about your research, which is really interesting and important work. So tell me a little bit about your research interests related to girls and women in sport and basically how you got interested in that topic.
So basically I have two lines of research. The first one is focusing on examining physical activity in children. This is the work that I started with, probably my first love, if I had to have a first research love, of examining the home environment and the family environment and how those environments, so thinking from both a physical perspective, so what are the equipments, what are the materials, the tangible items that children have available to them that could increase their physical activity. I focus more on physical activity than sport. And then also the more social aspects, so those social connections between family members, thinking about social support, thinking also about within a child, self-efficacy, knowledge, skill, how can that also influence them being more physically active? So that's the first line, which really has a strong family component. And I have tended to focus on the mother-daughter connection. And so I'll talk about a bit more, like some interesting findings I've uncovered with that research. And then my second line of research, which is very dear to my heart because I'm a yogi. I love yoga. Yoga has done so much for me. And hopefully there are a lot of people out there now who are engaging in yoga during these COVID-19 times for the mental, physical, emotional benefits. And so that second.
Yeah, I know I've been doing my daily yoga, and I can see your yoga shirt there for as we're talking here on video. But yeah, I mean, yoga has been amazing for me. Every morning I do even 10 minutes and I feel so much better. So yeah, sorry I interrupted you and your cool project around yoga.
Yeah, please do. No, I mean, I could talk about yoga for the rest of this podcast, but I think it's just allowing ourselves in this very chaotic, non-normal time to find a space, even if it's like 3 minutes of closing our eyes, connecting to our breath, and doing just some gentle movement. What that will do to do for us mentally is just amazing. It's that mindfulness, that connection, that meditation, almost getting to that meditative state, that really, there are a lot of strong benefits associated with it. So yay for yoga.
Yay for yoga. Yes. I have an app that I was doing it free on YouTube, and the woman that I was doing yoga with, she had a new app and I thought I should support her. So I purchased the app even though I could continue to do it free. So, but you know, that's the thing. When we're at home, it's nice to support others when we can.
Oh, yes, definitely. Oh, yeah. So with the yoga research, I'm not focusing on children. I'm focusing more on African-American women. And so I got started in this line of research because, like I said, I love yoga, and I was doing a lot of yoga and trying to get my friends on board, mainly my African-American friends on board, and some of them were really hesitant. And the spaces in the Twin Cities, I mean, we have some really great yoga spaces, very supportive environments, but there's not a lot of diversity. And what I've found is that they weren't always the most accommodating, most inviting, I guess is a better word, inviting environment for, you know, sometimes overweight African-American women who were not used to doing yoga. Like, there's all these preconceived notions about who does yoga, how yoga should be done, how you have to be super flexible. And so I wanted to create an environment where it was all African-American women being taught by teachers that looked like them, whether it was racially or in body type, and seeing what kind of supportive environment could possibly be created in order to, and we were focusing on cardiovascular disease risk factors. So increasing physical activity, decreasing stress, and decreasing hypertension, because those rates are pretty dismal sometimes in the African-American female population. And it went really well. And so that's how I started with the yoga research, and it has really grown into something that, this seems to be taking off.
I love that line of research. I mean, with yoga, a lot of entry barriers to physical activity are space or cost. And once you have a yoga mat, which really is optional, you can practice at home on your own or in a group, and it's accessible. And so it makes sense. And the health benefits, as you know, I don't need to tell you this, are so great, physical, mental, emotional benefits of yoga. And to use that, especially now during this time where we could probably all do yoga all day long and it would be beneficial to us. Tell me a little bit more about your culturally tailored mother-daughter physical activity intervention.
So what I've done in the past is where, when I started working with children, I would start working with children in the school system. And so they were at school, they had to go to school, they were easily accessible. But one thing that I continue to realize is that we're working with these kids, and even though they have some say-so in terms of the decisions made outside of school, like with what they're eating and what physical activity they're able to do, they're not the true decision makers. They're the naggers that they can get their parents to sway one way or the other. But the parents are really the ones who are making the decisions. And I wanted to be able to connect more with the families and be able to get hopefully more longer, sustainable changes taking place. And so I had a mother-daughter physical activity and healthy eating intervention. It was a two-phase intervention. The first 8 weeks was intensive. They met three times a week with our interventionist, and we for 3 hours, and we split the sessions into like an hour pieces. And so the first hour was physical activity. We wanted to have the girls and their mothers move together in a very supportive environment. And so we chose activities that through focus groups, the women and the girls said that they wanted to do. And we wanted to first allow it to be like culturally tailored so that it was, I mean, if you look at the literature and you just look at the African-American culture, dancing movement, right, is really popular, something that many of us like to do. And so we had some gospel dancing because our participants happened to be Christian. So they embraced that and they said they wanted that. We had other types of dancing. And, contrary to what you hear this rhetoric sometimes of like Black people don't do blah, 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 whether it's skiing, swimming, yoga, whatever. And one of those red.
Insert activity of stereotypical beliefs. Yes.
Yes, yes, yes. So there's that rhetoric, and there was the rhetoric of Black people don't swim or Black women don't swim particularly. And so we had them swimming, and they wanted to swim, and they loved it, and they could swim, and they just wanted, you know, more supportive environment to do so. And so It went really well. There's one thing that I forgot to say that I think was really the successful piece, or what set us up to be so successful for the women and the girls being so receptive to what we wanted them to do, is that our very first session, we had a hairstylist, a beautician, to come in and talk to the women about styling their hair while being physically active. So this was a couple of years ago, and we've seen more of a, it's been a movement of Black women wearing their hair in its natural state. But before, you know, there were challenges related to Black women being physically active in hair. We spent a lot of time and energy processing our hair. And it was a thing of not wanting to get wet, not wanting to mess it up with sweat. And so the beautician came in and gave like very practical tips of how to manage your hair. So while you're being highly physically active, so that it was no longer as large of a barrier for these women to be active.
Yeah, it's, I think, you know, as a white woman who doesn't really think about my hair all that much in general, and maybe even less so when I'm working out, you know, I think it's one of those culturally relevant things that is, you know, if I'm a white woman as an outsider researching or doing research with a different population that's different from me, and I don't understand the barriers, I would never think twice to have a beautician come in and address that barrier. So I think what I love about this work is that it also reminds me of our colleague, Dr. Thule, Dr. Chelsea Thule, who was on season 2, episode 2, talking about her research with, and she's also done a mother-daughter intervention with East African girls who are Muslim. So they have a different cultural barrier with religion and clothing and the hijab and how to be active in spaces that are accepting to them. And I think as researchers, understanding those unique systemic barriers for each specific population so we can tailor the intervention to meet the needs of the community is so important, when one of the really great things about the work you do, Dr. Barr Anderson.
Yeah, and I think, it, you know, one thing, because, yeah, Dr. Thule has done some great work, and I think for anyone that, regardless of the race, the background of the researcher, because every population is not homogenous, right? You have to approach them like they have had their own experiences. And so I'm a Southern Black, right? I've had my Black experiences as a Southern Black woman moving from, you know, from the South to the Northeast to Midwest. And so my experiences in many cases are different from some of the experiences of the participants in my previous studies, but we have to have that willingness to be open and to learn. You know, one thing that I learned really early on when I was in graduate school, I just remember my advisor was a white female. She was a physical activity epidemiologist, Debbie Rome Young, and she was doing epidemiology studies with African-American women. And I asked her like how she got into this field, like being this white woman from California, working with Black women in Baltimore, and how she was so successful. And she said that she recognized she will never be a part of the population. Like, she's not a Black woman. She will never be a Black woman. And that she was just open and willing to listen and learn. And that the women that she worked with, that they began to accept her and realize like her true intentions were pure and they were good. And so she was able to do some really great work around physical activity and diabetes and hypertension in that population early in her career.
Yeah, I think that's a good tip for young researchers who are wanting to do community-based intervention work, is if you are not part of the population you want to work with, it takes a lot of time to build trust and relationships and authenticity with the community you want to work with. And oftentimes as researchers, we're accused from the ivory tower of dropping in out of the tower into a community to do some research, and then we disappear again. And we certainly, that is not how we want to do our work in the communities that we're in, especially at a large land grant institution like the University of Minnesota, where our mission is to serve the greater good and the public. So, Dr. Barr Anderson, tell me a little bit more about a project that I know you're queuing up, which I think is really relevant right now, maybe more so than ever because of how this COVID-19 virus is impacting African-American populations differently and really uncovering health disparities within our system for African-Americans. You mentioned you're currently on sabbatical, so thank you first for taking time out of your precious sabbatical to do Tucker Center Talks. But tell me about your new work around racism and microaggressions and the effect on African-American women's health.
So it's not like a project per se that I'm working on. It's more so of me wanting to be more intentional to incorporate this work into the research that I'm doing. I'm tenured, was lucky to earn tenure, and not lucky because I worked really hard. Let me not say.
Yeah, it wasn't lucky. You work your butt off for that.
I have earned tenure. And so with tenure comes the ability to be able to explore. I feel free. I don't feel as, I don't know how, I haven't tried to articulate this, but there's something about the pressure of being pre-tenure and wanting to work with a minority community, but then there's these forces that are pulling you different ways because they're just responsibilities and things that I needed to accomplish in order to get to that point of earning tenure. And I look back on my career and I've always, for the work that I've initiated, I've always focused on African-American people. And so, related to physical activity with the bigger goal of wanting to address obesity. And so, there's a lot of the focus on you got to move your body and you got to eat healthy, right? Which are two really important pieces to the puzzle. But depending on who you're working with, there are other factors that are also coming to play, right? So I can give you a piece of equipment, or I can make a park available, but what are some of the kind of social stigmas or the societal issues that may be preventing this population from accessing this equipment that's right there, that everyone else is like, it's right there. So why aren't they using it? Or we've created a food market or, farmer's market really close by. Yeah. With fresh fruits and vegetables and you have the access. Why aren't you utilizing it? And so, particularly with the work that I've been doing with my yoga and thinking about stress more and how, it manifests throughout how it manifests like in someone's life and, wanting to be much more intentional of looking at these deeper issues, right? We've been at this work I've been in my career for 20 years of looking at obesity related issues, and we're making some strides, but many more strides need to be made. And for working with African Americans, it really has to do with the systemic, institutionalized racism and micro and macro aggressions that are in place that we say we want to do something about it, but nothing's being done about it, really on the larger scale. And so for me, I've struggled, I can be honest on this podcast, I've struggled with tackling this information and reading and really digging deep into this information before, because living as a Black woman in a predominantly white area, I have to interact and deal with white people all the time. And there are feelings, emotions that rise up. And sometimes I'm not 100% sure how to process those feelings. And so for me to keep my sanity and to keep my kind of some level of peace, I had to tread lightly in terms of how I wanted to navigate gosh, I hope I'm saying this in a way, because it's really, I mean, it's really tough to navigate it all. And so for my sabbatical, having the year-long sabbatical, knowing that I would have the space to be able to read, have the conversations, be able to process the information, and then be in a space where I'm not, that I've allowed myself to whatever ill feelings that may arise regarding white people to come up, to be able to have them process and you know, put them in order. And so that's what I'm doing. I mean, it's been derailed with this homeschooling with kids a bit, but I'm still reading and digging. And so, yeah.
You're bringing to light the fact that a lot of times as researchers, we want to investigate things that we're interested in and impact us personally. But when you're talking about really serious systemic issues of institutional racism and microaggressions that are all, you know, you deal with every single day as a Black woman, and now you're reading about it and digging deeper, it can be very traumatic because it triggers things. And then I think you're really wise to give yourself the space and the grace to read about this and process this in a way that feels good for you, so you can integrate that into your work. Oftentimes we don't have that space to do that. And I know I struggle with seeing systemic and institutional barriers in my own work, and those are the hardest ones to change. So then you feel helpless. You know, I really want to do this work to create systemic change and help people feel healthy and well, or in my case, in the occupational landscape for women in coaching who are experiencing sexism and harassment and discrimination. And then, you know, you bring in their intersectional identities, as a Black coach or a Black lesbian coach or a mother coach, and they're experiencing all these isms in the system. And how do you start breaking that down? You know, sometimes at the end of the day, I just feel depressed. You know, how do I ever do something good that actually does make a difference? And I don't know, maybe some days you feel like that as well.
Yes, 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 yes. And it's, yeah, and because, I mean, I'm sure you see it, like you see, it's like the problem is right there. And I'm like, how can others not see it, or no one else is talking about it and helping to connect the dots? And it does. It's really tough work. It's heavy work, really, really heavy work. And you have to be ready to, it's just heavy work. It's heavy work. I'll stop there. The emotions that comes out, it makes you doubt. I have to keep on reminding myself of, like, there are really good people in this world who are also fighting the good fight. But, like, you see what is going on and what people are doing, it makes me doubt humanity sometimes. And so. And so that's what I've been, in pertaining to really African-American women. Don't want to forget about the men and, you know, reading more so, but my focus has been a lot with African-American females because of, like, more dismal statistics related to their health outcome or our health outcomes. So,
yeah. And I think for people that maybe aren't familiar with the data on health and physical activity of African-American women, we know that, you know, in terms of gender, that girls in general are less active than boys. But then when you start looking at their intersectional identities, that Black girls are less physically active than white girls, and that those disparities in physical activity get larger as they get older, which then can lead to many health disparities in terms of obesity and diabetes and cardiovascular health and mental health and well-being. So, you know, that's kind of the starting point for those people that aren't familiar with that. I think starting to address those health disparities with physical activity interventions that are meaningful is such a key part of the great work that you do, Dr. Barr Anderson. So I wish we could, maybe we'll have you back on and we can talk more about the work that you do, because it's so rich and so needed and so important. Tell me, as we wrap up, what would be sort of the top three key sticky ideas that resonate with people from your research when you tell them what you do? How do they use it and apply it? What resonates with them?
I guess the first piece, because as I was saying earlier, that there are some preconceived notions about who's doing yoga and what yoga is for, and that yoga is for everybody. Every aspect, from the breathing to the movement, is for everybody. And luckily, with the boom of social media, you're seeing more representation of different body types, different abilities, different skin colors doing yoga. So if you think yoga's not for you, I guarantee that if you do a Google search, you'll find someone that you can relate to, whether it's race, sex, gender, your ability, that there's someone there who will show you that it is for you. So that's number one.
Okay, important one. So number one, everybody listening, do some yoga. That's the take home. Get out and do some yoga. All right.
Yes. Number two, I think it will be, you can't underestimate the power of community and social support when it comes to being physically active. And I think it's even more prevalent now with the fact that we are, you know, social distancing and we are physically distant from people. And but I think that a lot of folks aren't, that they're able to maintain their social connection to a lot of people, or those people that are really important in their lives. And so when you're trying to make that behavior change, that you having the support of those around you, those key people in your lives, encouraging you, doing it with you, goal setting with you, that it's just really important. That behavior change is really hard, right? To change a habit, it's incredibly challenging. And so for you to increase your likelihood to be more successful, you got to rally the troops of those who you care about, who care about you, to help with the transition and making that change. So can't underestimate community and support is number two.
Okay, good take-home tip. And bringing it home, tip number three, drum roll.
Yeah, I was like, so this one is more so, I would say, is just for people in general. And it's related to the work that I do, my health disparities work that I do. I don't know. It's like sometimes I feel when I look out into this world that there's these divides, that some people feel that like ethnic, racial minorities, or I don't know, if someone is overweight, that stigma of being overweight, that people don't care about their health, or that they don't want the same thing. Like they don't want the good things in life. And I guess my thing is that we're all human. We're all wanting the very best for ourselves. We're all wanting the very best for our communities, for our children. Maybe what that very best is, it looks different, but that we all want that. Like, I the things that I see and the things that I hear, either via social media or that's written or that's actually said, that we all just want to be healthy and live a good life. We really do. And it just looks different in different populations. And so I think that acceptance is really, really important for, if we are really going to be able to tackle the health disparities. I mean, it's come up a lot with the COVID-19 because we're seeing how African-American communities were already at a disadvantage with a lot of chronic diseases, and that with this now coronavirus is just compounding the situation, that for us to really be able to make some long lasting changes, everyone has to believe that people want to live, they want to live, and they want to live a good life, and they want to be healthy. I'm just
That's so important, I think, because there's been also a lot of talk, and I just was listening to something yesterday around the link with mindfulness, is when we're mindful and we're listening to others that are different from us, and we have empathy and care, and we connect on a human level, that is so powerful. Because for some people, the first response is, well, you're not like me, so we don't share these common life goals. And then there's this hierarchy, like, I'm better than you. And we're all human. We're all trying to do the best we can. And having that sense of humanity and empathy for each other right now, I think, is more needed than ever. So I think that's a great way to end the podcast. Those are three amazing takeaways, Dr. Barr Anderson. I really appreciate that. Any last words of wisdom that you really would love to impart with our listeners around your research?
The thing is, well, I first want to thank you for your flexibility and for allowing me to be on the Tucker Center Talks and to have a voice to share a bit about my research. And it's just like, you got to keep on moving your body, keep on being open to those around you. So just move more. Just move your body, any form of fashion.
I always joke with my students, you know, our students in the School of Kinesiology, who many are studying health and well-being and physical activity. And I say to them, you know, someday I'm going to write a one-page bestseller, because there's so many books and products around being healthy and well. And I said, I'm going to write a one-page bestseller, but I'm going to give it to you free today in class. And here's the one page. Move your body and eat anything in moderation. And they laugh because, you know, people think there's some magic formula. Obviously, it's a little more complicated than that, especially when you talk about what we've been talking about here with the systemic barriers it's a little more complicated, but it gets them thinking about their careers sometimes in a little bit different way. So I've just given my secret away, my one-page bestseller.
There you go.
I'm Megan Kahn, host of the We Coach podcast. Every 2 weeks, I chat with female coaches, administrators, or industry experts from a variety of sports across the country. Be sure to tune in every other Thursday on your favorite podcast player for inspiring conversations. I'll see you there.
Okay, so as we conclude this episode of Tucker Center Talks, I'd love to hear from you. So tweet me at Tucker Center or to me directly at Dr. Sports Psych. Check out our website at tuckercenter.org and follow us on Facebook or Instagram. You can find the show notes with links to Dr. Barr Anderson's lab and her bio and resources for this episode at wispsports.com. Look for Tucker Center Talks under the Listen tab, where you'll find many more conversations from around the world about women's sport. Thank you for listening and helping us turn up the volume on women's sport. That's a wrap for episode 8 of Tucker Center Talks. I'll be back in 2 weeks' time. I'm your host, Dr. Nicole Lavoie, signing off to make a difference in the lives of girls and women in sport.